Today is Wednesday, the 29th of May, 1996, and this is Heather Adler interviewing Donald Axon at his office as part of the Port Washington Public Library Aviation Oral History Project. Thank you for agreeing to participate, Mr. Axon.
My pleasure.
Mr. Axon, where did you grow up?
Well, most of my early life was spent in Jamaica, in Queens County, and a couple of years in Arizona, in the southern part of Arizona. The Huachuca Mountains near Fort Huachuca.
Really?
Yes.
Why did your family come to Long Island?
Well, my parents came here as small children. Their families came to Brooklyn, and then as time went on, they moved to Jamaica, and that's where we were raised as young children.
I see. What about Port Washington? When did you come here?
Well, my parents moved to Port Washington in 1951. And I came in 1968, but of course Nassau County was, I went to school mostly in Nassau County when I was in high school, and grade school, grammar school, whatever. I went to Woodmere Academy, which is on the South Shore. But my father was a pilot and flew out of Roosevelt Field in the early 30s, late 20s and early 30s. And Nassau County was, of course, you know, the cradle of most of the aviation in the country.
What was your father's name?
Michael. My mother's name is Ann. She's still alive. My dad passed away about 10 years ago, so.
So how old were you when you first became interested in flying?
Oh, probably one and a half or two. My father, as I said, was a pilot, and he used to take us flying, and my brother and I just fell in love with the whole idea of being off the ground.
I guess that's how you became interested. As a child, did you ever read magazines or build model airplanes?
Yes, all of that. You have to remember that the 30s, when I was growing up as a youngster, was an era where aviation, sports aviation particularly, was becoming very, very attractive and very exciting. A lot of records were being broken. Lindbergh had, as you know, left from Roosevelt Field in the late 20s, and since then a lot of the other aviators came to Long Island, mostly because of the terrain was perfect for airports, airstrips, and we were caught up in that entire activity and syndrome as a family.
Did you have any heroes who were involved in aviation?
Yes, all of them.
Oh.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm doing my seventh book of poetry is going to be called Courage the Early Aviators, and it's going to be prose poems. It'll be illustrated in coffee table, and it's 1915 to 1940. So what I've done is I've written four or five poems, some of which have been in magazines already, and they're in the first person about the men and women aviators who flew not only in Long Island but flew in that particular era, decades from 1915 to 1940. Setting records of all kinds, and what really fascinates me is two things. One is that they came from every social and economic background strata, and they just pursued the business of exploration with tremendous courage, because the ability to fly with aircraft that didn't have engine troubles and other kind of problems was, and plus weather. So these intrepid aviators, explorers, would conquer all kinds of things. Time, they'd be in the air for many, many hours. They wouldn't know the terrain. They wouldn't, they'd have to deal with weather. There weren't really any radios. So it was a very different kind of flying than we do today.
The second thing
was the fact that women aviators were very prominent in those years. And the only two disciplines where women had an equal opportunity was aviation and, you want to guess, astronomy.
Really?
Not in medicine, not in law, and not even in education. So, and there were some women who flew biplanes from England to Australia. Incredible feat of determination. Open-air biplane flying over the mountains of Turkey, when you have to fly up to almost 20,000 feet, flying over the jungles and the deserts with unreliable engines. So the aviators, and most of them were mechanics as well. But I'm going back now and picking up the history of both the World War I flyers, the ones who appeal to me, and the explorers like Richard Byrd, Amelia Earhart, and others. Sometimes it'll be a manufacturer like either Lockheed or some of the others who have created the different... We don't see today the ambience and the environment that was true 60 years ago in the 30s, 20s, and 40s even to some extent. It changed, of course, after the Second World War.
In what ways?
Well, I may be jumping ahead on some of your questions, but...
We'll go back.
Okay. You have to look at Nassau as an era and time of Fitzgerald, of East Egg and West Egg, where the gentry and others had huge properties on the North Shore. They would fly out of their lawns. There was no such thing as controls and limitations and things like that. And there were numerous airports, and there were numerous places to land one's plane. I had a chance, when I first got my license, to fly to some of the old airports before they were closed. And as a matter of fact, I don't know whether you saw it, and I wrote an article that the New York Times printed.
Yes, I believe I did.
About
yes,
the aviation. It shows a little boy in this plane and so forth and so on. And that will give you some of the information there, which is all accurate, about the airports that were closed, and they were all over the place. We had one in Hicksville, Syosset. In Port Washington, there were airports that people flew out of. I don't know if they were actually official places, but down where the polo field used to be in Sands Point, there was a lot of flying done. And the Harrimans, I'm sure, and Guggenheims flew out of their places.
To get back to you a bit, will continue with that in a little bit. You mentioned that you flew with your father when you were 1.5, 2. Do you remember anything about your first flight?
Yes, I do. I remember, I was probably about 3 when I started remembering things, but maybe even older, various things. One was that we would be able to fly into Mitchell Field and Floyd Bennett Field, which were military fields, and we were able to fly in there as civilians, and it was no problem. Another thing was how very open Long Island was. The farms in Nassau were very extensive, and it's very hard to go back and imagine with all the development we've seen that these were just open fields and little towns. Once in a while you come to a town like Hicksville, that was the center, or Hempstead. But between them, there was no continuous suburbia as we have it now. Transportation was very different. We had Jericho Turnpike as a 2-lane road. We had Northern Boulevard, 25A. And we had a few, on the South Shore. And these were east-west roads. But,
so you would land in, like, fields?
We sometimes did that. There were a lot of airports that we came into in Hicksville, as I said. Suffolk County had a tremendous number of them. We would go to Far Rockaway once in a while. We'd go to Atlantic City. My dad headed a flight out of Roosevelt Field in 1933, and I think he told me to open up the airport in Montreal. In other words, it was a goodwill flight from the pilots at Roosevelt Field. And maybe half the planes got there. Why? Because the engines failed the pilots, and there was no crashes. I mean, there were no... fatalities or anything like that, but just that the engines overheated and they weren't that well made.
What type of plane did you fly on in those early days?
Dad used to take us up in a Fleet biplane he would rent. He also at one point had a Stinson Reliant, not the Gullwing Stinson Reliant, but the 1931 version, 1932. And then later on he got a Fairchild 24 with an inline Ranger engine, which is a very, very pretty plane. There are still some flying around. It had wheel pants covering the wheels, and we had a lot of fun. As a matter of fact, I saw him crash that plane up in Kingston. He came in too fast to a small field, and he didn't have enough practice, and he nosed over. But we repaired the plane and took it away and had it fixed and did some more flying. Yes, it is.
When did you first learn to fly?
I guess I learned to fly Well, I took my first lesson, my first official lesson, I was 15. And I said I was 16, and my brother was up at Cornell, and he was flying. And so I started taking lessons, and I soloed when I was 18. And I got my private pilots I got when I was 20 up at Middlebury College with a flying club. We had 20 of us owned a plane, and we flew for very little money.
So what was the year of that? Maybe
1951.
From whom did you learn?
Well, in our class, we had returning veterans from the Second World War, and one of the 20 of us was an instructor, and another guy was a mechanic, and we had a little plane on a cow pasture.
What type of plane was it?
It was an Aranca Champ, 7AC, Aranca Champ, and didn't have a starter. So what we would do would be to either, we should have tied the tail to something so that when the plane got going, we would be, but very often we would pull the prop through and then go around and get in the plane, which is probably not something they recommend, but we did it. We were youngsters and weren't as careful as we are now.
What was involved exactly in getting a license, the pilot's license?
It was officially 40 hours of both solo and dual. We had to do cross countries, meaning to demonstrate we could navigate to various places. I think I went from Glens Falls to Lebanon to Middlebury on one of my trips. We didn't have any, we didn't have the VORs, the basic navigation facility that are used now. Of course, we're going to GPS and LORAN, other things like that.
And pardon?
GPS, Global LORAN, L-O-R-A-N, which is going to go out of date as soon as GPS becomes universal. So we had to do what we call dead reckoning, which was to see and fly, meaning see various landmarks and then fly a course based upon that. You have to remember the wind is always blowing, so you can get off your track if you don't follow, make a correction for the wind. But it was fun, and it was relatively easy most of the time to know where we were. Vermont is fairly easy because you have Champlain and you have the mountains, and Long Island is fairly easy also. But when it gets very hazy, very foggy, that becomes a problem. I remember being lost a couple of times over in New Jersey trying to get to Pennsylvania or back because everything looks the same.
Imagine if you're going on landmarks and such, it would be difficult.
Well, as I say, especially when it's hazy.
Yeah.
And we...
really?
That's why eventually I got my instrument rating and my twin engine rating, eventually, because there are times when, well, first of all, what we call VFR and IFR, VFR visual flight rules, IFR instrument flight rules. We teasingly say IFR, I follow roads, but it really is it's really identification for being able to fly solely on instruments in the clouds and be able to do approaches to airports where they have an instrument approach system of one kind or another. There are three kinds.
What special skills are involved in piloting a plane?
Well, I'll take your question, I'll rephrase it to say the two basic things as far as I'm concerned is common sense and coordination. Coordination is important because at some point you start to feel the plane in the air and you hear the motor and you know whether you're usually, not always, I mean, you listen for it, and if it changes its tone, then you're either speeding up or you're slowing down. That means your nose is going up or your nose is going down. And the coordination of being able to make turns without overcorrecting on the rudders and to make a coordinated turn and to be able to approach into an airport and to come down at the proper speed. And that's coordination. Common sense is what you don't fly when you don't feel well, you don't fly when, and a lot of people do, you don't fly in from, if you're not an IFR pilot, you don't fly into bad weather from good weather, and that's where most of the accidents do happen. Even IFR, when we see a line of thunderstorms, most of us will not depart through it or around it. We'll just stay put.
What are some of the challenges of flying?
I suppose it has, the challenges, there are a lot of them. Well, we'll talk about the fun and the excitement also.
Yeah.
But the challenges are to know one's limitations. if that's a challenge, there's a challenge out there. Do I go or don't I go?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have enough gas? Oh, heck, I could make it. The challenge would be I'm going part way. This has happened to me in years past. And all of a sudden I see a block of what looks like a wall of bad air, meaning it's just very hard to go through. And do I turn around? And it's closing in, let's say, on me, and the weather's turning bad. Now, they say the best maneuver is a 180, turning around and going back to where you came from. But there is a disease called get-there-itis, and a lot of pilots have gotten in trouble from doing that. So the challenge is to go sometimes when you should go, when you can go, and whether the doubts and the anxieties that people have, pilots have, just anxieties and doubts, or are they realistic problems that have to be contended with and should be, and the flight might be turned down because they're too grave. On the other hand, weather forecasters very often exaggerate the weather on purpose, and they should, portraying a possibility of thunderstorms and so forth and so on. Typical summer weather reports almost daily have in them chance of thunderstorms. Now, what we have to do, the challenge is to determine whether or not we're going to have that kind of a situation or not.
What is it that you love about flying?
Well, it's a lot in my poetry.
And
all of my books seem to have the feel of flying in them, against gravity, sliding down the wind, the latest illusion, the Hawk's Dream, Colors of Infinity. There is something very special about being in the air that cannot be replaced when one is on the ground. It's being able to be, above the earth and seeing things that you don't see otherwise. I'm in love with clouds, and there's something very amorphous, very ephemeral, about clouds that I find just awe-inspiring. And I talked about the three-dimensional part. I think it's a spiritual. It finally becomes spiritual for me, in that it's almost a religious experience, and very, very fulfilling. There's a sensuality also of the flying. Whether one's doing acrobatics or not, there's just the beautiful motion of the plane and the excitement of coming into a small field. Up in Vermont, I have an airstrip at my house. It's small, and I have to land my biplane or my other plane very carefully there. But it's a challenge. That's a challenge, to come into a little place where, and I also land in farmer's fields up there, and I land on hills with my Super Cub, which is a bush plane that they use in Canada and Alaska for flying into short fields and theoretically difficult places. So I think that flying is very exciting. Flying can be very exciting. They say, and this is a cliche, that flying is, in passenger planes, in airliners, is sheer boredom interrupted by moments of stark terror. And when you're sitting in the back, and even pilots, I would tell you that amateur pilots like myself, who've been flying a number of years, were not quite professional. But we've had a lot of time in the air. We don't always like to sit in the back and have somebody else fly. My wife and I made a trip to Alaska in our plane 2 years ago, a little less than 2 years ago, in the summer of 1994. And we were with three other pilots. It was in a nice twin-engine plane. Everybody wanted to fly. Nobody wanted to sit in the back. So, you know, that was... The challenge there was going to Alaska and back, and being out of radio contact, being out of radar contact, and depending solely on the plane and one's ability to fly in places. Exciting. Absolutely gorgeous. Flying around Mount McKinley, or even Long Island, flying over Swans, and flying, you know, out at the East End, and seeing boats, sailboats on the water, and seeing people doing their lawns and seeing kids playing in schoolyards. And I mean, it's just magic. It's really magic. I've never gotten over my enthusiasm for it.
You did mention, I'm just going to seize upon quickly, that you're an amateur as opposed to a professional. Yes. What exactly is the distinction?
Well, professional is somebody who flies, whose occupation is flying alone. Commercial pilots, if you will. There are some commercial pilots, very few of them, who are just beginning, so they don't have the skills or the time in the air that some of the amateurs do, but by and large, an amateur is somebody who doesn't fly every day, who doesn't fly 3, 4, 5 times a week, whatever.
How do you feel when you're in the cockpit of a plane?
Terrific, usually. I really love it.
What are some of the sentiments?
Well, it depends on the kind of plane that you're flying. This twin-engine plane, which I'm flying now, is very sophisticated and very complicated. So the checklist. Yes, it's a Chancellor Cessna 414. It was a RAM conversion on the engines. RAM is an outfit in Texas that takes old planes or your plane, and they'll give you a new engine. They'll rehab your engine, and that's their basic business. But they were starting to offer complete aircraft, including paint jobs. And there's a picture of mine on the wall. You can see it in a little while. Well, I can get you a copy to take with you. We did the interior and exterior new avionics. So the 5 or 6 or 7 pages of checklists, both as we're before we start the engines, and then the inspections outside of the plane and so forth and so on. Well, that's one kind of flying, and then taking that plane, it's fully de-iced, meaning it's got the kind of equipment that we can fly in icing weather where we want to. It's also turbocharged engines, which means that's pressurized, that the pressurization of air compressed will permit us to fly at higher altitudes. Because we're generating the compression in the engines for the oxygen coming in from the outside. And then, of course, the cabin is pressurized, too, so we can fly at 3,000, 4,000 feet, even though we're at 22,000 feet. So we can fly over weather. A lot of times that other planes cannot, and that's quite exciting and very fulfilling. The other kind of flying is in the Stearman biplane, which is a World War II training plane. It's actually a Boeing Stearman. Boeing, because of the Halliburton gear, and it's an N2S3, that's its designation, 3993P for Papa. There were 4,000 of these planes, roughly, built in the Second World War for the primary training for the air cadets and Navy and Army. They were built, some of them, in the Philadelphia shipyards. And today there's probably 300-400 of them still flying. And it's a beautiful thing, and it's good for acrobatics. It's just good for being, I was flying this weekend in Vermont and just being in the open air and seeing everything and people waving from below and that kind of thing. That's fun too.
What was the first plane you owned? The first plane you owned?
Well, the one in college, I had a 1/20th share. I put in $50 and everybody else put in $50. Of course, the dollars are worth more now. We bought the plane for $1,000, and we all learned to fly. Then when I graduated,
what was it?
It was that I mentioned it to you before. It's Ronca Camp.
Oh, okay.
The second plane was just after I graduated. My high school teacher had a Ronca. I'm sorry, I don't mean a Ronca. Aircoupe, E-R-C-O-U-P-E, which was a tricycle landing gear. Most of the other planes were tail draggers. We can talk about tail draggers if you want. That means a wheel at the back. So it's two in the front and one in the back, as compared to some of the models I hear in the office. That's a tail dragger. And the picture of the biplane right behind you, turn right around. See the yellow one?
Oh, yes.
That's a tail dragger.
Okay, so it has a wheel on the bottom
back.
On the back and on the bottom.
Which is the rudder, and which is underneath the rudder.
Okay.
And so those are tail draggers. The second plane was an aircoupe, which sat two people side by side. Now, most of the planes were one behind the other, tandem. It had a canopy, and we put a tiger mouth on it and made it look like Flying Tigers. The Flying Tigers was a group before the Second World War who fought in China with P-40s. They were fighting against the Japanese. General Chenault, started the squadron, and Americans were most of the pilots were Americans. And the Aerocoupe was made by Aerocoupe, but it was sold in Macy's. And you could actually go into the toy department or something like that and buy a plane. Well, I bought this one secondhand or third hand, because secondhand planes are not the same as secondhand cars. They're usually in good condition. And then three of us got involved, my brother and two others. And we had it for 3-4 years, and we had a lot of fun with it. It didn't cost us much money. We flew it out of Deer Park. There was an airport in Deer Park.
Where did you keep it?
In Deer Park.
Oh, okay, so did you ever hold any jobs in the field of aviation?
No. Yes, well, we had, I say no, but at one point in Port Washington, we had a seaplane, company. I was
really, what was it
called? Manhattan Seaplane Service, Inc. And we flew it out of Ventura, which is a seaplane base. Was, I think it's pretty much closed now. John O'Neill was the manager. And there were 4 or 5 seaplanes. A lot of the men would want to use seaplanes to go into Manhattan, downtown, and they could fly in from Port Washington in about 12 minutes and land on the East River, which was quite tricky because of currents and the junk in the East River and so forth and so on. Fly under the bridges because it was safer to do that than over them, to come in for landings. So we had a plane. It was a 180 Cessna 185, which was roughly 4 passengers. Because of the weight of the pontoons, it made a difference. We had a 300 horsepower motor on it. And we also, later on, got amphibious gear, which meant we could land on land as well as we had retractable gear in the pontoons. 4 wheels, 2 in the front and 2 in the back, so that if we came into one of the airports I used to fly into Westchester with it, or anyways, Montauk, I could land on the land, and then if I wanted to land in Port Washington, land on the water, pull up the gear.
What was your involvement, if any, in World War II?
None. I was a little too young. Yeah.
What was the nearest miss you ever had?
Oh, but I did serve 8 years in the military reserves, and I did a little flying in the reserves, but not where I was the pilot. I was just sitting alongside somebody and enjoying the flying.
The nearest miss you've ever had?
Well, there have been several. I think mid-air collisions is probably one I would see first, where I didn't see another plane, or he didn't see me, and we missed each other by a very small margin. I really haven't had any...
When was that?
Well, probably 3-4 times over the years.
Oh, really?
I do have something from the FAA wings that they sent us for courses that we take, and if you take a certain number of them, then you can qualify. But the courses themselves were worthwhile, and the work that the FAA does is quite important, mm-hmm. quite important in terms of training and retraining. So the near misses... Well, I blacked out once doing some acrobatics in the biplane, and that wasn't fun.
No.
I mean, it wasn't fun to fight to gain my consciousness, but that's a rare thing. It doesn't mean that acrobatics are dangerous at all. And nothing major.
When did you get married?
When did I get married? What makes you think I'm married? No, I'm teasing you. I got married in 1950. My first marriage was 1953. And I used to take my wife and babies flying. And we had a lot of fun.
Did your wife have any interest in aviation?
My first wife did. My second wife is a pilot, Joan.
Oh, my.
She's a pilot, and... she's a good one, and it makes our flying together much
That's
nicer.
That's great. Is that how you met, by any chance?
No, we met on a tennis court.
Oh, okay.
She was on one court, and I was on the other, and I knew I wanted to get to meet her.
What has your experience been? You had mentioned earlier some stuff about female flyers. What has your experience been with female pilots and such?
Well, I can't say categorically that they're better than the men pilots, but they're every bit as good. The instructors, one of my first, when I was 18, I had a female instructor, and she was quite good. Of course, she was very pretty, and I wanted to do well on my flying to please her. But other instructors I've known, women pilots, have been quite good, quite competent. If it helps to be an engineer or mathematician, mm-hmm. and the understanding of the aerodynamics of aviation is important. Wind, currents, lift, drag, things like that.
How has the role of women changed over the years in aviation?
Well, what we see now very dramatically is women as both co-pilots and pilots in major airlines, that and also our air traffic controllers, many of them are women. So, and it was an anomaly at the beginning, but an aberration, but today it's very common. And when I talk to the air traffic controllers, I will say ma'am, or to the guy, yes sir, or whatever. But I find them to be competent, professional, and I think we'll see more and more women in aviation as a field.
All the better. Yeah, going back to your family a bit, do your children share a similar interest in flying?
No, the kids never got into it. My youngest daughter used to like to do bounces. She used to call it bounces and bumps when she was very little, but I think she's gotten away from that now. She's a little more... you were more concerned about being on the ground.
When did you get involved in the real estate business?
Well, I guess 1958, when I went out on my own. I was in the family lumber business, and I started on my own in 1958, and it's been a good career since then.
Is flying a release or escape for you?
Yes, very much so. I think very much so, and the reason being, very simply put, it's a very long, much longer answer than I'm going to give you, but very simply put, is that the need to concentrate on flying is of such a nature that you pretty much can forget about everything else. And we do concentrate. So flying, most of the time, concentrate. When I get up in my little plane in Vermont, I just tool around. You know, it's kind of fun going up in the mountains looking for moose and looking for beaver and so forth and so on. But when we do serious flying, as I do with the twin, it takes a lot of preparation. It takes a high degree of concentration when we're flying. But it's also the escape. Flying is sort of like an escape. Escape from being earthbound. Escape from symbolically or metaphorically. It's the escape from one's other life into a life in the air. And the metaphor, I think, speaks for itself. And that's why I write poems about it.
Yeah, we'll get into those later. Have you ever been involved locally in aviation?
Yes.
At Port Washington?
Well, if you mean Civil Air Patrol, I was involved in that. I was a first lieutenant some years back. We have organizations on Long Island. The Long Island Early Flyers is an excellent organization. I belong to that. They're restoring aircraft at the Mitchell Field, the museum.
Yes.
And also the history of aviation is very much part of their involvement. We have the Bayport Aerodrome Society, which I'm a member of, and we have the Antique Aircraft Owners, another very fine organization, and we have fly-ins. Brookhaven has one every year. Sometimes we fly into on December 7th to commemorate Pearl Harbor Day. A group of planes flies over the Statue of Liberty and drops flowers. And that's very kind of nice. And sometimes we're invited into Kennedy. Sometimes we fly to different places to just enjoy the business of other pilots and so forth and so on, flying to interesting places.
You did touch upon this, but what is your interest in aviation antiques and restoration projects?
I think just, I'm not doing any restoring myself, mm-hmm. you know, as a hobby. But to go with a very strong early continuing interest in not only aviation history, but types of aircraft that were flown in the 20s and 30s and 40s. There were a tremendous number of manufacturers of planes that didn't last on Long Island and other places. And some of these old aircraft, just very romantic,
like
I guess.
Which?
Oh, gosh, so many names. I would have to give you a list.
That's right.
Not that I know all the lists, but there's... the bigger outfits survived. It was Fairchild survived, and what they were doing at Republic and so forth. And so, and Grumman certainly is the best example of that. Grumman was more military aviation, whereas Fairchild was doing both. And there were just numerous... Forgive me for not remembering all the names or being able to give them to you, but that we had companies that built few planes to some that built several hundred. They were not only in Long Island, they were all over the country. But that fascinates me, and that kind of flying. Today, a lot of the aviators are going into the sports aircraft, which are the home builds, and very fast and built out of new modern materials, rutan type planes, you know, with the wings and the back and the experimental, they call them. And there's a very big organization called the EAA, which is involved in that. I think my interest is one of romantic involvement in the history, and being a little bit part of that by watching my father and the other men at Roosevelt Field, men and women, and the records that were broken and all the excitement. Very different than it is now. We didn't have computers. Phones were not very common. And so the business of traveling, being able to go to Connecticut without having to make a long drive, we didn't have expressways and parkways. So that was part of it too, being able to go places where you decided which route you wanted to take. And just the glory of being in the air, over the ocean. I mean, remember being very frightened, just go back to one of your early questions, as to my early experiences. I remember after the 1937 hurricane, flying out of the ocean and looking at houses floating on the water. It frightened me. I was a youngster. But that was interesting.
What, do you have a favorite type of airplane, by the way?
Yeah, I'm sort of thinking about that in terms of, do I have any one? No, I think I like them all. Most of them are very pretty, and most of them are very attractive. The biplane, of course, is special and very different. I have flown jets a little bit, but it's an entirely different kind of flying. Seaplanes, yes, very much seaplanes. Coming into some remote spot with a seaplane and just cutting your path in some lake is very nice.
What is the shortest plane flight you've ever flown?
Shortest? Well, the shortest was once when I was in Connecticut and somebody was going to pay me $10 or $20 to fly an Aranca 2, a stubby-nosed little thing he wanted to bring to Long Island. And I got up over the airport just as I was taking off, and the plane was shuddering so much I came right down. Other types of short flights, when something is wrong and you abort the takeoff,
uh-huh.
I've done that for different reasons. Something is going wrong and you determine that as long as you have runway left. And we're trained in twin engine planes, what happens if you lose an engine and so forth and so on, if you're committed, so there's a regular technique for that. The long flight, of course, is the one to Alaska, which was, I think, about 10,000 miles, 11,000 miles round trip. I'm hoping to fly to Europe one of these summers by way of Greenland and Iceland, Labrador, Greenland, and Iceland. You don't have that long. I mean, you do. You are over water, but it's only maybe the longest leg is 600 miles.
In what type of plane would you?
I would do it in my twin. We'd rig it with extra fuel, maybe. Not too many people, or maybe two, no more than three.
What kinds of changes in your attitudes towards flying have there been over the years?
I think greater respect for weather and unpredictable, fascinating weather for professionals who, in the bush pilots, who I am also fascinated by, with, who fly in all kinds of conditions where it takes a lot of skill and a lot of courage. So I think I appreciate it. I think my interest in the history of aviation is because today it's I mean, see, people say driving a plane. To some extent it is a little bit like that, especially with automatic pilot and things like that. But in the old days you didn't have that, and you really had to have hands on.
What do you think your greatest fear is?
Getting caught in flying. Getting caught in some situation where I don't have an out. They teach us that we should have an out. Somebody will get that. That we should have an out. That, for example, if you're flying to a destination and all of a sudden you're on an instrument flight plan and the weather turns bad, you must have enough time and fuel left, or enough fuel left to get to another airport. It's when I think something seriously goes wrong with the plane, and no, the wings don't fall off planes, but you can have an engine problem, you can have an engine fire. You can run into unexpected embedded thunderstorms. Ice is not as bad as thunderstorms. Fog is also bad, but we generally don't have to contend too much with that. And that's more of a detail which I can get into if you want to. But getting caught, getting trapped in some situation where you can't get out, that would be my greatest concern.
What advances in technology or materials have affected you?
Well, the navigational. Number one would be the navigational equipment. I think we assume that the engines are so reliable today that we don't have the kinds of concerns I alluded to before or spelled out before of engines just not maintaining their power and oil leaks. I did have a problem with I sprang a leak in one of the biplanes I was flying, and the oil was all over the place, and that can happen too. But in the conventional plane, not the radial engine. The radial engine is a big oil-burning thing like that, as compared to the other engines which are made, the Continentals and so forth, are among the very best. And the reliability of those engines is what makes flying very safe. Safety is obviously two things, the equipment and the pilot. And you have people flying who maybe shouldn't. But they get their tickets, and either they're good instructors or not so good instructors or examiners, and they're dangerous for themselves and people they fly, but not too many. I would say that flying is probably, we know it's safer than driving, but we don't usually are aware of is that there are probably five or six times as many train accidents, people being killed by trains, as there are by planes.
How many different types of planes would you say you've flown?
Roughly. 40, maybe.
Wow. Why do you change from one type to another?
Variety. The biplane is very different from the twin-engine plane. Seaplane is different from a Super Cub. Super Cub is the bush plane. It's a Piper Super Cub. Mm-hmm. It's an old Cub, and the reason they call it Super Cub because instead of the old 65 horsepower motor, it's got either 108 or up to 180 horsepower. We have 150 on ours, and we can land and take off in very, very short distances. And that's fun. And the twin engine plane is of a different kind, and a different kind of flying. So I think it's a variety of flying that appeals to me.
How have prices changed over the years?
They've gone up.
Okay.
They've gone up in relation to present value dollars are much different than they were. Planes have kept up and supply and demand. There's something interesting about, I mentioned before, it bears repeating, and that is that You don't buy a new plane the way you buy a new car. Most people buy planes that have been around for 10, 20 years, even longer. And they're just as reliable and serviceable, because planes must be licensed every year. Pilots must be licensed every 2 years. It's called biannual flight review. And medicals can be 1 or 2 years, depending on the class of medical you have. So it's a lot more thoroughly monitored than cars and things like that.
Well, that's good.
It is good. It's very important.
Yeah. What aspect of aviation means most to you?
Well, it's hard to break that down, but I don't think the most. I mean, I think the aspects of aviation which are significant are obviously the commercial aviation, which the world depends upon for travel and for commuting and various things like that. The aspect of being able to fly myself, as compared to being a passenger. I really enjoy being up in the air in the airliner, because even at 33,000 feet, I can look down and see things. I've learned to see better than I used to be able to see.
What would you venture to say about your future in aviation?
Well, I hope to be able to fly, and even when they have to lift me into a plane, and as long as I can see and run and manage the controls, I expect to fly for the rest of my life.
How has aviation changed over the years?
Well, it's become, from the in Nassau, I think by comparison we can talk about that, unregulated, uncontrolled, because there weren't so many planes and pilots, and there were many, many places to land. Now we have very, very tight limitations and restrictions. Before we didn't. And that's sad, kind of sad. That's why I like Vermont so much, because there's not too many, you know, not too many airliners and airports, and we can fly places we can't here. You must stay away from airports here. There's a regulation.
Slide 2 of our first tape. Let's move on to the connection between aviation and your writing. What was the first poem you published that dealt with aviation?
It's hard to remember, but I did have to go back to my first book, Sliding Down the Wind. But all of the books have a lot of flying in them. I think the poem permits the verbalization of a feeling, of an experience, and the creation of that experience for the reader is what I think I try to do. I do it for myself initially, and then hopefully the listener or the reader can hear that. I did a reading at Hofstra where they did a multimedia thing, and the kids in the communication school, they taped me up for a poem, and then they created a scene for that, for the poem, as they put up on the screen. It was kind of interesting. But the poems deal with all aspects of aviation,
yeah,
both from the excitement to the fear to the relationship of nature, of the spiritual part of flying, of the feelings one gets when one is in the air. And I think we said we'd have a poem or two that I would read that would maybe give that as an example.
Terrific. Did you have any models or any works or authors who, before you had written about aviation and that
well,
inspired you?
Initially, no. I think I was just doing it from my own experience, from my own whole cloth. But as I started reading about other writers, I certainly Beryl Markham wrote beautifully about West with the Wind. Amelia Earhart was a very fine writer. She was probably a better writer than she was an aviator.
Okay.
She was a very good writer. She became better and better. And certainly Anna Mara Lindbergh. I was both an aviator. She used to fly, of course, with her husband, Charles. They made this trip to the Orient in a single-engine seaplane in the 30s, doing a route for Pan Am, in a sense. But she is a very fine poet, a very fine writer. So I think I've come to appreciate aviator writers, Saint-Exupéry, others. It's an expression, I think. Flying is an expression of self in a different media than the gravity, Earth held gravity or humans. So it's that uncanny, spiritual, sensual business of being in the sky.
In one of your poems, probably more than one of your poems, you used flying and controlling the plane as a metaphor for living life and guiding others.
I don't remember.
It was the one that your son was with you.
Oh, yes.
And
it's called Tracks of the Father, Tracks of the Son.
What has the idea of flying symbolized for you in that context, perhaps?
Oh, well, my son is not an aviator, so I can't say I fly with him and he's the pilot, but in that particular poem, it was just a transition of generations. And I think I end by saying, you know, I was flying, he was sitting behind me, we were going to Vermont. It was bad weather and I almost landed and he trusted me and so forth. And at some point, he's going to take over and become my father. I mean, eventually become your parent's parent. And it's sort of a cycle, generational thing.
Your poems, you seem to describe light as emotionally charged and sort of shaping the world. And how did watching a sunrise or sunset from the sky serve as an inspiration, or didn't it?
Well, it does. It certainly does, because the viewpoint, I call it three-dimensional. Really not, because it's obviously three-dimensional on the ground too. But sometimes you see different things in sunsets than you do on the ground. I mean, you're limited with the sun going down in one particular place, whereas even after it goes down, whereas when you're flying, you don't chase the sun so much as being able to see it from various different viewpoints, the colors really, and the way the tones and shades and hues are changing every 5 or 10 minutes.
In one poem, you described the world from a bird's eye perspective. How did flying changed your perspective on the world around you?
It made me, I think, it's a good question and I'm glad you asked it. It made me feel my own limitations and my own smallness in terms of humanity and the world. We become, at least I do, become very much involved with things around me and my own little life and my own little world, but get up in the air and you just, and the universe, of course, you sort of are reminded about your small place. Just one of billions of people.
Thank you so much, Mr. Axon, for this interview. It's been wonderful. And
good questions, Heather.
Thank you very much. And this is Heather Adler ending the interview with Mr. Donald Axon.